C1B 1 and 2.
Number 17A.
Once that Mrs. Eddy has presented love as principle, telling us that we should use that which we already know and use those very few things and be faithful over those few things, that they will make us ruler over many. Then she goes on to the subject of love as life, which I have epitomized like this. By following the true idea of being, we reap indestructible life. You see, the aim is always set here in life. The aim is indestructible life. But the prerequisites for it is what? Is naturally to follow the idea of being. You know that follow is an idea of life, it's the way of life, and the followers of life are therefore those who go the way of life, who use the method of life, the true method. The marginal heading is narrow pathway, indicating life, and there she says that this pathway is straight and narrow. It's a very clear-cut statement that says the way is straight and narrow. It's not roundabout. It says right away, you know, not every way leads to Rome. There is a one way, the straight way, and that's narrow, very narrow. You can't deviate very much from it. The narrow, the ways are really quite narrow, and you can't deviate. See, this is science. Whereas the mystics always have said that every way leads to the aim. You can go any way, it's all right, it's individual, you can go the way you like, you will always somehow, sometime get there. So we should not misunderstand, therefore, the individuality of life and saying that everyone has his own way and can go his own way. That's not what Mrs. Eddy saw, Jesus was teaching. Why should there be all kinds of ways to get there if there is a science and a method? Why should there be a teaching at all if every way leads anyway to the goal? Then you don't need a teaching, you don't need a science, you don't need a system, you don't need anything except to let yourself go. So let's be clear that we don't put all that mysticism into Christian Science by misunderstanding the true sense of individuality, because the true sense of individuality says it's a very narrow way. Namely, you have always to go out from principle, and only that individuality which is derived from divine science is actually the only way. So often students say, But how can I know which way is right? Am I God to define which way is right? Therefore, shouldn't I let everybody go the way they like? Well, naturally, we can let everybody go the way they like, but we are interested not in that random mystical thing, but in a science, and therefore there must be scientific criteria according to which we actually can decide what is a right way and what is a wrong way? What is a straight way and what is a roundabout way? If we don't have a criteria, scientific criteria, to decide what is right or wrong, and say, how can I play God and say what is right and what is wrong, then we better give up. This is already a sign that we haven't really grasped the nature of science, but that we are still in a religious, mystical sense of being, and let everything go the way it goes. Science is very strict, and therefore we must judge or be able to judge a way according to scientific criteria. What is that scientific criteria? And Mrs. Eddy goes on and shows that he that believeth on me shall not see death. That's the way to go. To he that believeth on me, he who has an understanding of that science, he shall never see death. The science is given, therefore we have to take that science and go the way of science. You remember we already had in the earlier part, in the chapter on creation, that she spoke about the way of Christian Science. So there is a way that is scientific, not mystic. Therefore a way that we can judge according to scientific criteria. And so she says that we must perceive the true idea of life, and this ushers us into the undying realities of spirit. We can see that this true method, that the scientific method, as the way, ushers us into being and into the realities of the undying spirit, so that we get the true idea of being. It says, when spiritual being is understood in all its continuity, then man is found in indestructible life. Can you see, she always puts these two together. It says, there is a way, if you go the way, then you are sure of finding life, capital L. What is needed, she more or less asks, in order to go that way? And she says, in the marginal heading, consecration required. Consecration is an idea of life which says that you put everything what you have into the one scale. You have to give everything to it. Everything you have to it. And therefore, she says, it demands a living sacrifice. You can see, she doesn't say, just say, it demands a sacrifice. But here, because she wants to show that we have somehow to reach that point where we see that being is, indestructible life is, that we have to give a living sacrifice. And then she shows what this living sacrifice is. First, she shows it from a negative point of view and says, when begotten of the beliefs of the flesh, and if we serve them, we can never reach in this world the divine heights of our Lord. So she shows how we cannot reach that aim through a false method. What is that false method? That she says, if we are begotten of the flesh and serve the belief of the flesh, then we can never make the demonstration that Jesus made. Because Jesus, as we have seen before, his origin was divine mind, not begotten of the flesh, conceived and born through spirit. Therefore we could see, well, then there is no hope for us. Then we can never reach the divine heights or indestructible life if we are begotten of the flesh. As she says here, when begotten of the beliefs of the flesh. But she also says, and serve them. See, if she would only have said, if we are begotten of the belief in the flesh, we could say, yeah, actually we are. Each one of us is begotten of the flesh. So there is no hope for us. But she says, and if we serve it, then there is no possibility to demonstrate the divine heights. And therefore gives the answer to it and says, how do you free yourselves of the belief that you are begotten of the flesh and serve it? And then she brings in that terrific statement about divine signs and shows that if we see that we are born of divine science and not of the flesh, that then we can do it. You know that terrific statement which is unique in the whole textbook. There is no other statement in the whole textbook that shows this point. There she says that the time cometh, see, it's like a prophecy. The time cometh. It is as if she would look into the future and says, this is what the next millennium will bring us. This is the problem of the next millennium. Namely, the time will come when the spiritual origin of man, comma, the divine science, comma, which ushered Jesus into human presence, will be understood and demonstrated. Usually in the textbook she speaks in a more religious way about man being created by God, born of God, that man's origin is in God, or perhaps in mind. And now suddenly she says, no, his origin is in divine science. Quite different. You see, as we go further in the line of development from the Adam dream, out of the Adam dream into the next 1,000-year period, we'll have to see that we drop that sense that man is born of God, especially as God is only a name for whatever you know about that name. But that we begin to see this is still an old religious concept, that there is a God and that God somehow creates man. See, it has still some kind of an anthropomorphic taste in it. Whereas if we would see that what is called man has its origin in a science, then man becomes a scientist, because only like produces like. And so the great point is that we can see that we get away from that old paradigm that somewhere there is a creative origin called God, and see that man is actually, as a compound idea, nothing else but the infinitely, infinitely restructuring of the ideas constituting the signs of God, the sign, divine signs. That therefore man is actually nothing else but the divine system of reference seen in its continually individual restructuring of that science. There I like to see my origin. And if you do that, I know from experience that if one does that and sees that one is a scientific proposition and not just a creation of a God who is good and terrifically big and I don't know what, but that one is a specific scientific proposition having an individual mission within a science, not within a God's creation, but within the science, that one gets so much nearer to one's true being, that one begins to see that all there is true about what is called man is an infinite calculus of ideas, calculating constantly within the plan of love. So try to take that sentence very serious and try to see that we can go the way only then when we leave behind that rather religious connotation that God is our Father, and I have quite a mystical sense about it, that God is our Father. Where is God? We don't know where he is. What is he? And we say, oh yeah, what is he actually? And we define him as the divine system of reference. So we define him through divine science. And we suddenly give to that term God a higher, more scientific meaning as divine science. And see, that's the origin of our consciousness. Science bringing forth a scientific consciousness. And having a scientific consciousness is man. And one gets a completely new sense of what one actually is. So let's see that love as life, that's the point of love as life, is the motherhood bringing forth as fatherhood the true sense of man. But here love is divine science, and bringing forth from divine science the true idea of man means that we go back not to God and see that we are God's creation, go back and see all there is in being is actually nothing else but that the divine constituents of being, the divine categories of being, are constantly at work, are constantly bringing forth their new combinations, their new calculus. And this is all that is about being. And we free ourselves of being as some sort of a mortal, some sort of a man. It's then feeling that all there is this infinite calculus of ideas. We come to love as truth. I have epitomized it like this, and I said, love as truth is living aright brings the final destruction of error. Again, you see love, the final destruction. Love is always all or nothing, as truth naturally brings about the final destruction of error. But how? What is the method to do it? I guess she wants to show, I have to say, that's my interpretation, that what she wants to bring out over a longer period here is a sense of doing again the works of living aright. That living aright is a power, is a living power, and is a demonstrating power. It's not thinking aright, it's living aright. And here we have a sevenfold description of that point, and therefore I run quickly through that sevenfold presentation. As mind, therefore we will have to see what happens there in the way of living around. She says that truth brings light to false beliefs. A false sense, namely, hides the divine possibilities and conceals scientific demonstration. So we have to see that we don't have a false sense of demonstration. This is always the biggest thing. We always, students of Christian Science complain so much that they don't make their demonstration, that Christian Science doesn't work for them, that they are disillusioned about their demonstration. They never ask, if they really ask for true demonstrations, if what they are asking for are actually true, a true sense of demonstration. And if they would first analyze that, they would then perhaps see that they ask something wrong. And therefore, because they ask something wrong, they can't make that demonstration, because truth will never really demonstrate a wrong sense of truth. Never. Truth will only demonstrate a right sense of truth. Again, we can see that we should look much deeper into ourselves, into our motives, into our desires and aims, and first ask, are they right? Have we a right then sense of what we are looking for? Or is already that wrong? And usually one doesn't ask that. One usually has a sense, I know that things are ailing me and give me pain, and that things are uncomfortable, so it must be error, and therefore as it is error, I must find the truth about it. And actually, that may not work in most cases, because the condition one is in that ache us, give us pain, and trouble us, are very often the most healthy situations. And we should first see, why are we troubled? Is our motive right or not? And first ask about the motive, our sense of truth. So that's the very first thing we have to do, first to ask, is our sense of truth really true, or is it just a human sense of truth, and therefore wrong? Because she says, if it is truth, then we can be quite sure that truth spoken is the light that shines in darkness, and the darkness may not comprehend it, but it's still the light. And therefore we can rely on the fact that it is going to demonstrate itself. So she goes on to the next subtone of spirit, and again asking us, now what shall we do in order to have a right sense of demonstration, a right sense of truth from the point of view of spirit? I have summarized it like this: to demonstrate truth, our whole affections must be set on spiritual and not on material things. Again, you have the same subject coming up again. The moment we come to spirit, it's always a question, where is your heart, where is your mind, where is your soul, where are your affections? Are they directed towards the spiritual, or are they directed towards the material? She says, if we follow truth and do the works of truth, you see, doing right, then that implies what? What is implied by doing right? She says, loving God supremely. That's the marginal heading. And explaining that as our whole affections must be set on spiritual things, that we are trusting more the spiritual than the material, that we forsake the foundation of material system. Can you hear? Always spiritual, material. Therefore, doing right is again putting our weight into the right scale, putting our trust in the spiritual, putting first things first, choosing the right prerogatives. What is first in our aim? Is it material? Is it spiritual? It's a great, great challenge constantly to say, do you right or not? So she asks here, what must be our motives? And her answer is, again you get the tone of right, to live right, true intentions, true motives. This, she says, will open the way, and nothing, now you get the sense of love and spirit, nothing can hinder your advancement. Advancement is the unfoldment of spirit. Nothing can hinder it. See, the force of love is so strong that if we set our priorities right, that we can trust that it will fulfill itself. So a lot of it depends really always on our motives. We really should be always asking ourselves what our motives. Sometimes we don't ask it. Sometimes we just take something for granted that it is right, not knowing that we have perhaps a false sense of right, and therefore are working according to our sense of right, and therefore put our trust into something and our efforts into something that is not right, because we cannot quite evaluate our motives. So the great point here always is, in spirit, to make a good distinction, or at least to make a good decision as to what our motives are. You know, when you read those terrific verbatim reports of John Dolly of the Oxford School, 1949, that was his pinnacle of teaching, those summer schools, that was really the height of what he saw. He put so much stress always, because practically every day he comes up with the same thing and says, just first analyze your motives. What are your motives? Why are you studying Christian Science? Why do you want Christian Science? What is your motive? What do you want to attain? Do you want to attain really spirituality? Or do you want to attain something else than spirituality? Do you want to attain a better job? Do you want to attain a better position? Do you want to be a bigger shot in the world? Do you want to be better than the others? All kinds of questions that can be asked if we ask ourselves honestly, truly, why on earth do I want to study Christian Science? Why on earth, actually, am I quite sure, quite honest with me, do I know why I should put so much energy, so much love, so much of everything into the scale of Christian Science? Do I know why? And analyze that. Because that's here the point of spirit, really. Are our motives spiritual or not? Are they unselfish or not? This is always the great question. And without answering that honestly, we may have difficulty in advancing. Then something can hinder our advancement.